Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one.
Hi.
It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Carol the Coach. And Carol the Coach has got so many things to talk to you about today. Hey, I am so happy to be here. It is March already. I cannot believe it. I know you can't either. What is it that as we get older, time flies by faster? I don't know, but that's why you have to be able to make good use of your time. If you're in recovery, that means that you've really got to take into consideration all those things that actually make you feel fulfilled and whole. And if you're contemplating recovery, you got to decide. You have to set an intention for yourself and ask yourself, what is it that I really want out of life? I mean, there's no doubt about it. When you set an intention and you get with the right people, preferably CSATs, you're much more able to follow through on the kind of recovery tools you're going to need to get clean and healthy. Now, you know, we're all pioneers in this field. You're a pioneer. I'm a pioneer. If you're a betrayed partner, you also are a pioneer. And we are just learning for the first time about different programs, different research, and different opportunities to understand ourselves better. And that's why I was so excited to get to book David Fawcett, Dr. David Fawcett, who wrote Sex Under the Influence, Understanding and Healing from Sexualized Drug Use. Now, he has had this specialty for a while, and he's going to explain to us when sex and drugs are combined repeatedly and compulsively, there is a high risk of developing sexualized drug use. We're going to talk about that today, and if you think that you might be suffering from this problematic behavior, you know, you can send me an email. I'll forward those to Dr. Fawcett and see if we can't get you some specialized help, because let's face it, this is something that's relatively new to our community. I don't think we really knew about it till Dr. Fawcett wrote his first book. So, Dr. Fawcett, I'm so excited to have you on the show. Welcome to Sex Health with Carol the Coach.
Thank you so much. I'm really so thrilled to be here. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, you know, you've written two bestsellers on chemsex, compulsive sexual behavioral problems, and drug and really any kind of substance abuse. And so today I'm hoping that you can explain to our listeners what is that and, you know, not only what defines sexualized drug use, but what is this chemsex thing that we're hearing a lot about, we're seeing it in the movies. I mean, it really seems to be an issue that lots of people are suffering from. So let me first ask you, what exactly defines sexualized drug use?
Yeah, this is a term that's emerging more and more now. It's kind of where the research is landing. Most of us in the field have long recognized co-occurring disorders, right, where we have two or more things going on. But when we talk about the mixture of substances and sexual behavior, whether it's in-person sexual behavior or even pornography, that's a special kind of connection that really hardwires the brain in a way that's quite dangerous. I started noticing it because I started getting clients who were in recovery for a while, but they kept slipping on their drugs. And then it turns out, guess what? They're looking at porn, or they're acting out sexually, or they're gambling, or they gain 50 pounds. You know, we just transfer addictions, well, I call it whack-a-mole, until we really deal with the common threads underneath it. But I think more and more we're seeing a lot of sex addicts in my work. I think in Terry particularly see guys who are using alcohol, they're using cannabis, they're using other kinds of drugs, amphetamines particularly, and they may not even consider it a problem. I'll get into more detail later about the addictive ritual. Maybe just a drink or two to kick them off. But every time they have a drink or two, they end up, you know, getting in trouble with their sexual bottom lines. And so I think that combination, and if I can just say, too, a lot of people confuse, well, what if I have a beer or a glass of wine before I see my, that's not what we're talking about here, right? But we're talking about over and over ritualized behavior where these two are combined, where one triggers the other, where if I do one, I start to think about getting in trouble with the other. And so they become all kind of commonly entangled in this addictive ritual.
Well, absolutely. And entangled rituals have been part of understanding about sex addiction from day one. I mean, I remember when Patrick Carnes said back in the late 80s, when the sound of AOL happened, you know, turning on that computer and hearing that, I thought, disorienting, ugly sound, but for a sex addict, it meant, oh my gosh, I'm going to get to start. I'm going to get on the internet. And with AOL, that meant you'd wait minutes for your images to come up. But again, it was that sound that triggered the ritualization of sex addiction. And so what you've been studying and what your book deals with is what ritualizations are there that involve any kind of substance abuse, or even, as you said earlier, you know, a habitual behavior that starts the process going, right?
Exactly. And you mentioned Carnes, who did, he termed it addiction interaction disorder, but that's the idea, and we're all really talking about the same thing here. But I think what we need to do as professionals is help people recognize it when it's coming. But for, just to quote Carnes here, he looked at, these are for sex addicts, and he found that 38% were also addicted to work. And I know a lot of times we get guys into recovery, or men, women, rather, a sex addict was in recovery. It's so easy to just substitute that compulsivity to something else. And work is one thing where they really land, obviously work addiction, food, nicotine, shopping, alcohol. Those are the big five for sex addicts. And it's just so easy to jump, unless we recognize that when our clients are doing that, or when our loved ones are doing that, the chance of relapse on our primary addiction actually goes up, because we're not totally sober. We're just kind of transferring that compulsive instinct to other outlets.
Well,
and not really solving the big problem.
And like you had referenced in your book, I mean, the dopamine hit that you did get with sex addiction can occur with substance abuse, or can occur with, you said, the top five, spending, shopping, gambling, that kind of thing. And I remember, boy, back in 2007, when I just had gotten out of my CSAT training, I wanted to go to the major drug and alcohol hospitals and explain to them that if somebody curbed their drug or alcohol use, they needed to be aware that sexual compulsivity could go up. And would you believe that most hospitals denied me? They said, you know, we're not saying that doesn't happen. We're not saying that you wouldn't do a great job of orienting our staff. However, we get a lot of philanthropic reimbursement from people that don't want us talking about sex. So we can't make that part of our programming. I bet you your books are in their libraries right now.
I hope, because unfortunately that same situation exists. I think we're talking very fine substance programs, but the household names often don't want to hear about this. And I think for many reasons. One, the reason you mentioned, I think also as CSATs or a sex therapist, where we're trained to kind of talk about sex to know our own issues. Like, we have some sort of awareness about that. I think a lot of times with some of the substance use counselor, they don't necessarily have that training. And if it comes up in group, they may not know how to do, how to redirect or how to kind of pursue, or they may shy away from certain topics, or in their one-to-one sessions, not know how to do a sexual history. So I think just they're not trained. Mm-hmm. And I think that problem still exists, sad to say. It's still a big problem where especially the drug treatment centers don't really want to see all this other stuff that ultimately is causing a lot of people to relapse, I think.
Yeah, I do too. And obviously, again, you're really a pioneer in this field. I mean, you made it your mission to explain how these interactions make it very combustible. I mean, all these addictions just, they explode. And so it really is important to look at any ritualized behavior and find something else to replace that with. Is it not?
Totally. And, you know, from the early days, too, now we have much more capable imaging techniques with fMRIs and PET scans. We know that, we know how brain looks if you're using cocaine. We know how brain looks when you're looking at porn. And basically, it's the same thing. It's different ways of pulling or pushing buttons to get that response in our brain. And so there's kind of any inlet, right? You can start with drugs, you can start with sex, but it's very easy to find a way to substitute to get the same effect. And it's very dangerous. So, yeah, that ritual is so important. I think a lot of times, I've worked mostly with amphetamines over the course of my counseling career, and people will say, well, you know, methamphetamine or cocaine, that's what brought me down. You know, cannabis didn't. So why can't I have cannabis? Why can't I have a drink of beer or two? And I'm kind of old school when it comes to total sobriety and I've lived my own life. But I think that's kind of dangerous. But then with some questioning, they'll usually come to the understanding, yeah, well, it's true, every time I smoke cannabis, then I do start to feel the impulse to use cocaine, right? That's the doorway, that's the entryway that leads to all these other problems. And so that's that ritual you're speaking of. If we can't look at that whole big picture and see how it looks, and on the tail end too, by the way, you know, sex and porn addicts and amphetamine addicts are intensity junkies, if you will. But at the end, when they're the remorse, the shame, you know, oh my God, I've done it again, what have I brought home, that kind of thing, then they'll often medicate that with other kinds of drugs, you know, alcohol or food particularly, you know, anything to numb, you know, that numbing behavior. So there's unfortunately, there's so many addictive options we have out there in the world. People self-medicate in all kinds of ways. But at every point through that ritual, it's very important to see the whole picture there, I think.
Okay, so obviously I'm speaking with Dr. David Fawcett, and he is talking about how important it is look at behaviors that contribute towards more dangerous behaviors, and that's ritualization. And then we're starting to hear this term chemsex. Can you describe or define what that is?
Yeah, the chemsex has become a real popular term. It's really describing the same phenomenon. The guy that coined the term is a man who unfortunately recently died, but in the UK, and he meant it to be explicitly for the experience of men who have sex with men or gay men. And this is where chemsex really kind of emerged as a thing in that community. But they were using methamphetamine and mespadrone, a bunch of other drugs in the sexual context. But he wanted it to include the trauma the gay community has had with the HIV epidemic over the years, and the shame and the stigma, that kind of particular set of circumstances that led to the use of these drugs and sex in that world. And so it's really the same behaviors we see with anybody else, but I think people are kind of honoring his parameters on using the term chemsex to refer to the gay community. However, that community has no monopoly on this, right? I had a lot of self-identified heterosexual men who get into these behaviors, and suddenly they're having sex with other men. They're not gay. They're not, you know, but these drugs lead to all kinds of behaviors. So that's where the term sexualized drug use is more of a universal term. But it's really when we get down to the weeds, it's the same thing as chemsex. It's just chemsex really defines it in the gay community. But boy, everybody is doing that. And increasingly, we're seeing these behaviors spread into every population, men and women, gay, straight, old, young, it doesn't really matter. It's really on fire out there.
Well, and so when you hear the word chemsex, you think chemicals and sex. Does it not mean that?
Totally. I mean, the chem in Europe, the word, the chems mean really drugs. So, and particularly amphetamines and a drug called one of the club drugs, gamma hydroxybutyrate. It's actually quite dangerous. It's a very close cousin to Rohypnol, the date rape drug. And so we see that being mixed up in this whole scene too. And a lot of sexual assaults taking place because of that. So a lot of dangerous drugs in the mix out there.
And I'm wondering, this is just off the top of my head, we know that male-on-male sex is so prevalent in the military. Is chem sex in the military?
Chem sex is everywhere.
Okay.
I have clients who were arrested while serving and kicked out. Sometimes with a more benevolent posture, they get them to treatment, but oh yeah, I mean, it's everywhere,
it's everywhere.
For sure.
Okay.
Now,
I want to ask, how often do these co-occurring patterns actually occur? I mean, you just said it's everywhere, but do you have any data to support?
And I think these numbers are probably low, but actually, when we were speaking of Patrick Kern's work before, who did some of the same work when he was looking at that interaction, where he talked about up to a third of people reported one behavior in the past year. This is just in the general population. And about 20% reported two or more. And about 10% reported more than two. So we're talking drugs and, say, sex and porn or sex and gambling or spending or food, all these. And so about 10% of the population has three or more active addictions going on. And that, it just becomes all too common to just get around between all of them. And then there's been more data that really kind of confirms Karn's original kind of pioneering work in this 20 or 30 years ago. And it's, the more data we get, the more it confirms it. And frankly, the trend lately has been an increase. It seems to be that there's more people doing this for a number of reasons. For cannabis, for example, I think is legal now in many states, as most other states have medical marijuana, but I think the perception of dangerousness has lessened. And for the adult, cannabis is not methamphetamine, if we're going to put it on a dangerous scale, but for the developing brain, for adolescents, for example, people also think it's not a big deal. It's actually quite harmful to the brain of an adolescent. So it's becoming more and more common, and our cultural beliefs are kind of both what's the big deal. And this is why I'm asking your question, Carol, sorry, but even in recovery communities, and I'm in recovery myself and substances, I'm distressed to see that, alcohol is my problem, but what's wrong with cannabis or what's wrong with other things? I think that, for the reasons we talked about, can be, it's a slippery slope right back to the original problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there is some danger, I think, out there.
Well, got it. And we've known for a long time that there are gateway drugs, and that's what can make some of these drugs inherently not dangerous in and of themselves, but if they're gateway drugs, they lead to the harder things, and that causes a lot of problematic sexual behavior. Now, I'm going to ask you something. How do the following statements reflect a misunderstanding about sexualized drug use? The statement, let's get you sober from drugs, and the sex will take care of itself.
Kind of what we were referring to before, that's an attitude I think in most traditional drug treatment centers that don't really want to recognize these other behaviors as a component of a bigger addiction syndrome or ritual. And so they emphasize, I being specialized in this, I can't tell you probably hundreds of clients I've had over the years who were treated by somebody who said just those words, just let's get you sober and everything else will work out. And we know, unfortunately, I'm a sex therapist as well as a CSAT, and the sexual recovery takes a lot of healing and work. Oftentimes when people get used to having sex under the influence of methamphetamine or cocaine, it's very hard to come back to a sort of, quote, normal, sexual behavior. They can't function. And so it causes these very long-term issues unless it's addressed properly. So that's why I think unless we help people understand that. And the sex won't just take care of itself once we get sober. It's going to be an ongoing issue. Like we need the skills, and CSATs have those skills, and better than almost anybody, to really help heal that. So that's definitely a classic statement that I group a lot, for
And I agree that CSATs have the skills, but we all have comfort levels. And I, you know, I meet a lot of CSATs who say, I really am not comfortable treating my female clients who are using drugs to amplify sex. It feels intrusive for them. What would you say to a clinician who has that discomfort?
Right. I think underneath that behavior, which it seems at first I think can really become scary to a therapist or a clinician, what's really happening there? I think a lot of times women particularly are have a lot of body issues, body dysmorphia. They may have some history of trauma. They may have relational difficulties. And so they just, in many ways, it's the same impulse as men have. It's like, let me take something to step out of that into this other bubble where I don't have to worry about all that, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think the skills are there. It's just we have to recognize the way a lot of women these days are using drugs and alcohol. It's like, you know, step out of those problems, just get some relief from that, and spend a few hours at what one client of mine called bulletproof happiness, right? I can be out there, and these things aren't going to get to me. But so really, it's the same therapeutic approach. It's like, let's recognize just what this woman is doing as a way of kind of self-medicating. But the issues, we can bring it back to them. There are familiar territory for a lot of therapists, right? Because issues of body dysmorphia or even trauma and trauma healing just become an integral part of our work and other kinds of issues. So I think just recognizing that this just may be the coping mechanism. It's not a good one. It's a maladaptive coping mechanism, but it's helping her just kind of step out of issues that we probably do know how to treat if we kind of just take a step back and look at it across the.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, since I've been working with couples, and especially partners, it is so difficult for them to understand after a disclosure has occurred how their heterosexual husbands could have been with other males. And you would even go so far as to say that oftentimes those couples, if they're not gay, if he really is heterosexual, there's usually an element of substance abuse that is part of their interaction together, right? That.
Right. Yeah, you know, this is such a classic thing. I've had so many wives, you know, say, is my husband gay? That's often maybe the reason they go to treatment. Like, I need to know before we can heal this marriage. And in many cases, then there's such a thing as, you know, bisexuality that exists. But I think in most of the cases that we see, at least in the at the integrity, for example, and a lot of the heterosexual men that we see that have these behaviors, it's almost always some amphetamine use on board, cocaine, meth particularly, which is kind of, it's such a powerful dopamine hit that becomes the bright, shiny object in the room. That becomes what people are seeking, and it doesn't matter how they get there. And when they are in the influence of methamphetamine or in a preoccupation trying to get it, they really do anything. And that all boundaries kind of break down. So I've had a lot of guys who are straight. Indeed, they're heterosexual, but they've started to have sex with a lot of other men and women and transgender women and anybody, frankly, because in that state, their brains are one-track minds, right? It's all about sex and sexual relief and compulsivity. And so those boundaries get kind of washed away. The other thing I'll say, when I talk to sex addicts, it's oftentimes if they're men, having sex with men, there's a convenience factor too, right? It's like that's almost easier to arrange than with another woman. So there's a lot of reasons why a man might have sex with another man, only one of which is he's gay. I think a lot of it is drug, definitely check for drug use if that's going on. Just not any kind of reassure the wife. There's probably many problems there, including the addiction itself, but I think the sexual orientation is probably not one of them.
Right, and clearly you said the convenience factor, and if I've heard it once, I've heard it 1,000 times from men who've experienced other men, and develop that compulsivity that says, clearly, I am not gay. I don't want to date a man. I don't want to kiss a man. I don't want to live with a man. It was out of convenience that sexual interaction was accessible. It was immediately accessible with very little hassle. There was no call me tomorrow. There was no let's go on vacation together. It was really all about the sex. And that is so hard for women who are relationship oriented. And actually men are too. But when sex trumps relationships, it's all about sex. And so they were relationship oriented, had compulsive problematic sexual behavior, and then fused that with some other substance, at least one, as you said, maybe not two or three, and their brain was hijacked at that point.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I would bet if you ask them, what are you thinking about while you're having sex with a man? They're probably not thinking about a man, right? They're probably having a heterosexual fantasy in their head, but what's happening physically is, you know, with another man at that moment. So it's complicated, and I totally understand how a partner can be very distressed by that, right? But I think it's really, it's more of a factor of the addiction than anything else.
Right, and just one last word about partners, because we have a lot that are here and listen to the show. And as a matter of fact, David, this show is for sex addicts only. 2007, there was not another podcast on sex addiction. I had the only podcast. And 1 year into it, I looked at my demographics and 52% were women. And immediately I went to, well, that's a lot of female sex addicts. And then I went, oh, no, that is women trying to understand their husbands. And so I really respect how podcasts, how books, how, you know, there are so many avenues to learn what is going on with your significant other. I'm going to ask you a technical question, because one of the things that I'm trying to determine is how homosexuality, how gay sex is different than heterosexual relationships or heterosexual sex. So, you know, one of the things that I've always known is that oftentimes when you're in a gay relationship, there are other people that are part of your sexual community. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and I'm sick as a gay man myself. Uh-huh. Who's been married 20 years to another man.
Uh-huh.
And we have chosen to be monogamous in our relationship. However, we have a lot of friends also with long-term, committed, very loving relationships who have made other decisions. Maybe they're so-called open, right? Maybe they're emotionally committed, but they'll have sexual encounter, transactional things, you know, once in a while up there. And other relationships, other times it's more elaborate in terms of different people in the relationship and so on. So I think, and I've given this a lot of thought, I think the difference is that in the gay community overall, there's just more of a permissive attitude to do what you want, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that is that it's gotten much better now since I was younger, but I think that to be gay, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, there's a lot of stigma about it, and so people just kind of decided to rebel and do whatever they wanted. I think we've gotten actually more traditional over the years, but I think there are options that, and I've had a lot of straight guys say, you know, well, if I could, I would. But, you know, in the heterosexual community, it's just the norm is much more firmly defined. But it's interesting to me when the gay marriage bill passed in 2015 that it's people have become more settled, if you will. And not everybody, of course, but I think in my experience anyway. So in the bottom line, I think it's not that different, except going back to what we said about opportunities. I think there's just opportunity out there if you want it. And I think a lot of times, and I was, by the way, I'm not to say that there's not partner trauma or anything like that with my gay relationship. This morning I had something with a gay man who's just discovered his husband 25 years, has been seeing escorts and on breakups and, you know, for years. And it's the exact same.
Devastating.
You know, brother pulls out, right? He's totally traumatized. And so it's, that dynamic is the same. If your expectation is that you're in a committed relationship and then you have this discovery and, you know, blah, 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 it's the same kind of devastation as anybody else.
Well, and I've had to say, because I don't deal with many lesbian women who have sexual compulsive problematic behavior. I just don't. But I won't have gay men that say, we had an open relationship. We agreed to discuss everything and give permission. So for him to have had this deception for 25 years is beyond my comprehension. I mean, it's a real, I don't know that it's any better or any worse, but it just is a real atrocity to what you thought you had, right?
Yeah.
And I love that you're saying that we may be getting more traditional because now things aren't as repressed and we're open.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a big controversy when all this was going on 10 years ago about, was gay people, do we really want to just mimic, you know, heterosexual life? And is marriage really what we want to go for? And I think it's really important just for recognition, but it's for all kinds of other benefits as well, not only social. But I think it's just right now we have options. But it's interesting to me that given those options, people are kind of tending to go toward more traditional kinds of things. And that may be just me and my world, right? There's a big world out there. But in terms of the guys I see, and I tend to see gay men a lot of couples. So a lot of people who are established couples want to stay that couple and heal the relationship if there's a problem. So maybe that's a bit of a skewed view from based on my office, but that's what I'm seeing.
Well, that's certainly what I'm seeing in the heterosexual world, that most people want to stay together and work together. And that's why I wrote Help Them Heal. It's how to get to restoration and post-traumatic growth, which is that 12th step, which is giving back and finding some sanity out of an insane situation and all the growth that occurs in between, right?
When you mentioned post-traumatic growth, that's a wonderful concept that I use a lot. Mm-hmm. That I mean, we can actually heal and maybe better than we were before.
Oh.
In our relationship.
100% I believe that with the couples that I work with. And, you know, of course there are some couples that cannot get through this and there's just too much wounding. I have so many questions, but they're off task. So I want to get back to your book, Sex Under the Influence, Understanding and Healing from Sexualized Drug Use. What has the response been to this book?
Well, it's fairly new. It's only been out less than a month, so it moved up very quickly in a high ranking and in the psychology and relationship categories. I've had some friends of mine and some of the big names in the CSAT world do reviews. I've got wonderful reviews back from people, so I'm very excited about it. I think this really does try to bridge these two worlds that have been kind of divided, as we mentioned when we started out today, the kind of substance use treatment world and the sex addiction world. And I found just some people on both sides need help understanding the other and making that bridge, because our clients are probably experiencing both. And so we're only treating half of it. Mm-hmm. We're doing a disservice to our client. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that would fill a huge gap.
So what I heard you say is the heavy hitters are loving it. And it really is an opportunity for you to understand yourself better as if you're into chemsex, but it's also a way for clinicians to get more expertise about this so that they're treating their clients with efficiency and empathy and they're in the know. And I say, when you know better, you do better. And this book is one way to get there, right?
Now, I'll say it was written specifically with both tracks in mind, right? So it's very readable for the client. It's laid out in a way that kind of lays out what is this thing, what does it look like, but more importantly, more for half the book is recovery skills and tools and techniques. And then for professionals, it really helps them fill in some gaps too. So it's really to be useful for both. But I've tried to make it as organized as I can in a way that makes sense to people. Because these can be, if we're wading into territory that we're not familiar with, it can be intimidating with the terminology and stuff. So friendly out as clearly as possible.
Well, and you said you're a CSAT, a certified sex addiction therapist, and you're also you're a sex therapist. And was that through Carol Clark?
No, I'm actually on the faculty at Carol Clark's program. I got my sex addiction certification about 25 years ago with a program that was kind of the grandfather of Carol Clark's program. Carol does great work. I'm happy. It's a real joy to me to be a part of the students there and do the training with them. So that both perspectives, I've got sex therapy and CSAT, plenty of different takes, as you know, but really important, actually, to provide the whole picture. Mm-hmm. And that's what I tried to do here.
Well, there is no doubt that you sound like, look like an educator. And it is in who you are to educate others about this. And I do really believe we're pioneers in the field. And this is a growing population of people, and it's only getting worse. So I'm so excited that you've gotten this book out there, Sex Under the Influence, Understanding and Healing from Sexualized Drug Use. Now, where can they get it? Where can they get the book?
So on Amazon right now. It's also available as an e-book. If people are interested in that, you can just Google it. My name, Fawcett, F-A-W-C-E-T-T. Will be an audiobook out within a year, but currently it's in print or an e-book format on Amazon.
Okay. Have you ever done an audiobook?
Yeah, my first book was an audiobook. I didn't record it myself, but I have an audiobook out for less than a minute.
That's what I meant. I did Help Them Heal, and I said, I've got to be able to do it. My friends were like, this book is so written, like it, people are in therapy with you. And so I said, okay, well, I'm going to do the audiobook. It takes so much time. But it is, if you're a caring, loving, empathetic person, it's another way to put it out there and say, there's no shame in this. Let's figure out what's in your best interest, what would make you feel the best. And that's what I feel like this book is all about. Sex Under the Influence, Understanding and Healing from Sexualized Drug Use. Get it on Amazon. There's an ebook out there. If you don't want anybody to see what you're reading, that's a safe way to go about it. And I just thank you so much for being here with us, educating us, and just putting out this good information.
I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about the book.
Anytime. I said to David, I want to hear more about this book. Can you do my podcast? He said, I was going to contact you. So I appreciate that. Better do it before I retire, right? I don't know. Are you ever going to retire?
Well, yeah, I'm kind of retired in air quotes, but I'm busier than I've ever been. So I need to think about it. I just had a big round number birthday, so I need to think about taking a step back anyway. So, yeah.
Congratulations, and all the best to you, David.
Thank you, Carol. Wonderful to see you.
Okay, so everybody, I want you to go out and get that book, because the truth is, maybe not everybody, but I think we need to know about this. And if you had some experience with people of the same sex and you want to understand how that could have happened, and or you're a partner and you just don't, it is still the ultimate mystery. And for many, many, many partners, it is. I meant to ask him about trauma, because so oftentimes I believe that men that are not gay, that get involved in a lot of heavy-duty sex play as a young boy, or who were molested by another male, that trauma reenactment occurs. And although men don't want to reenact the trauma, it's almost a way to figure out, take control, and be in charge of something that happened to you. Well, the bottom line is, if you're in a relationship, it's catastrophic. It's catastrophic to the relationship. And Dr. Fawcett really writes that he has had countless clients who have come to him, and through their understanding of how their drug or alcohol abuse impacted the gateway, fused with the sex addiction, it exploded. It went out of control. So, again, a very good book. One more time, Sex Under the Influence, Understanding and Healing from Sexualized Drug Use. Okay, I'm Carol the Coach, and I look forward to seeing you next week. I've got Eddie Capricci and co-authors who have written, again, some childhood, some books on family of origin, childhood issues, and how that has impacted specialized groups. Okay, I'll see you next week for more Sex Help with Carol the Coach. And as I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times. Fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. And you know what I promise you? I'll get this intro fixed. I am taking it out right now, and I'm having it cut down so that I don't have to wrestle with it. I don't know why I'm having to wrestle with it, but I am. And it only takes a few times, right? And then you go, okay, I'm done. So have a great week, and I'll see you for more Sex Help with Carol the Coach. Make it a good one.